This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Let's talk about moving homeless people into hotels. That's what King County did when the COVID crisis started because it was very dangerous to keep large numbers of people in these emergency shelters overnight. So, since there were a lot of empty hotels and motels, King County contracted with them, and they moved homeless people into individual rooms. And a couple of researchers at the University of Washington wanted to study that to see what effect it has on those people. They are Rachel Fiall and Greg Colburn. They both have professor in their title. The first question is, did it have the intended effect of stopping the spread of COVID? I assume since it meant putting people in separate rooms so they weren't breathing on each other, that the answer to that would be yes.
The answer is yes. Some people were in double rooms, but a lot of people were in single rooms. But that is a significant difference from having mats on the floor 2 feet apart from one another. And so, you know, it's a pretty intuitive finding, but it was nice to corroborate that with actual data.
But there was also a side benefit, right? And that has to do with what it takes to get people back on their feet. So tell me about that.
Sure. So we spoke with folks about what was it like living in a hotel, and everyone we spoke with had spent time in our traditional shelter system. And it was amazing just to hear folks talk about, I think, many of the things we take for granted and what a big improvement that is for people who are used to traditional shelter settings. So things like having your own door that you can close, having a private bathroom, having some space to be able to get away and just clear your head if you don't want to be around other people. So hearing about the effects of what I think many of us take for granted was really interesting and powerful.
So it sounded like their lives suddenly got very much better.
Yeah, I mean, the interviews we conducted with people were actually pretty moving. Like, people were so grateful to have had the opportunity. You know, many people said in their interviews that they thought it was too good to be true. But when they got there, you know, what really prompted this study was service providers who work with these individuals on a daily basis, going back to the county and saying, you know, we're really seeing a pretty significant change in a lot of these folks. And that change was stemming from the fact that they were getting good rest. Mm-hmm. They were able to relax a little bit. As Rachel mentioned, there was a much greater feeling of safety and security.
Well, changes like what?
Well, I think a visual appearance. People just look better. Mm-hmm. You know, men were shaving and they were showering every day, so hygiene improved. They were getting 3 meals a day. And so instead of having to leave in the morning and having to go out and, quote, hustle for food, as many people said, they were being fed. And so that certainly helped. They were attending medical appointments and doctor appointments when scheduled, which is sometimes difficult when you're in and out of shelter. And I think one of the interesting findings was what kept coming up in conversations was this, what I'm calling a future orientation. And so people were saying, you know, when you're living in crisis, which, you know, emergency shelters are named emergency shelters for a reason. It is an emergency. When you remove the emergency, when you remove the crisis, people start to say, you know, I want to pursue a degree. I want to get a job. I want to find my housing. And so what this setting allowed them to do was start to think, instead of just how am I going to get through today, I'm going to start thinking about what does my life look like a month or 6 months or a year from now.
Yeah.
And so it's still too early to know if that will actually materialize in those outcomes, but at least it got people thinking that way.
I do want to add that all of this is still within the context of a pandemic. So while it was an improvement, the folks we were speaking with were still dealing with the same challenges the rest of us are in terms of getting around and lack of, you know, there's not an abundance of jobs right now and other things that are making life more difficult for all of us.
But what I got from reading the coverage of this was that in the course of doing the right thing according to public health, isolating people during a pandemic, it also became apparent that putting people in shelter, pandemic or not, providing a private space created a dramatic difference in their lives that might, and I guess we have to stress might have a long-term effect and might move them towards getting off the streets entirely. Is that a fair conclusion?
Yeah, I think you know the caveat might is proper, but I agree with you. And frankly, you know, some research that we do is challenging because the findings are potentially might be contested here. You know, these are pretty intuitive findings to suggest like the difference between being on the street or being in a shelter with 100 people sleeping 2 feet from one another and having to leave at 6 a.m. every day with all of your earthly belongings versus having a room where you can sleep and shower, keep your belongings there when you go out to the store. Yeah, it has a big impact, and it's putting people in a position that feels much more like a life that we all experience on a daily basis if we have housing.
Let me ask you this, because if this were to spread around the county, there would, of course, be questions beyond whether it's humane. People would want to know if it's safe. So were there any security problems when you put a large number of homeless people into a hotel?
The one that we have in our executive summary of the research right now is looking at 911 calls from the shelter locations when they were congregate to the hotel locations. And what we saw was a pretty significant fall in the number of 911 calls. It's not to say there were no 911 calls, there were, but at a far lower rate. And what we heard in the specific interviews corroborates that in the sense that conflict is somewhat common in a shelter setting because people are in crisis and they're very close to one another. And so people repeatedly in the interviews said, it was really nice if I was somehow having an issue with another person, I could just go up to my room, close my door and relax a bit. And that de-escalated situations. And so again, a somewhat intuitive finding, but the data did corroborate that.
What I want to emphasize is all of this was done during an emergency and very short-term timeframe in response to the COVID crisis. So we have been continually impressed at how quickly the different government and nonprofit actors were able to move in this setting. I'm not sure that's translatable to what we might expect in terms of a process outside of the context of a pandemic.
Right. Well, the pandemic created, I think, the space to be able to do this quickly without a lot of controversy because people's minds were elsewhere. But I think what it shows is that it's not impossible to pull off. In other words, you could do it if you wanted to. The question is, do you want to, which may change once the pandemic is over. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And I think you know, we're all aware of the many negatives associated with this crisis in terms of loss of life and infection and disruption to life and the economy. I would say, would we have done this without COVID-19? I think it's unlikely, even though those who work in the shelter system have been saying for years, we need to think of something better because this is suboptimal. And so I'm not grateful for this crisis at all, but I am grateful for the opportunity to demonstrate some pretty compelling findings. So it is it's a silver lining in what is an otherwise obviously pretty tragic circumstance.
Rachel Fiall and Greg Colburn, University of Washington, their study was on the effect of moving homeless people into empty hotels in King County. Thank you both very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. It is sponsored by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. For Brian and Carter Robinson, an ordinary trip to a batting cage became something extraordinary when they stumbled on a bucket of worn-out baseballs. CBS's Steve Hartman is in Montgomery, Alabama, where fate brought two incomplete families, that is, together and made them both whole again.
There you go.
A couple weeks ago, Brian Robinson and his son Carter were at this batting cage in Montgomery, Alabama, when a random stranger threw him a high, hard one to the heart.
There was this bucket of balls with a note.
The note read, "Hope someone can use some of these baseballs. I pitched them to my son and grandson for countless rounds." The writer went on to say that his family is now grown and gone, but what he wouldn't give to pitch a couple of buckets to them. If you are a father, cherish these times. Brian and his wife Stormy read that note with tears in their eyes.
It felt like a moment for us.
It still does.
It does. We need to soak in more of our kids and time with our kids.
Just the message the author intended.
I was just hoping it would inspire some people.
Randy Long used to love watching and coaching his kids. So much so that when he came across that old bucket of balls in his garage, he couldn't bring himself to just throw away the memories. He says he needed closure.
It was like a goodbye, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was a sign off type thing. That chapter is gone. Let's see what else is coming on.
But unbeknownst to Randy, his baseball days were headed into extra innings.
You want a fist bump?
This week, he met the Robinsons at a local park where Randy learned about a void in Carter's life. The boy lost both his grandfathers at a very young age. They never saw him play.
We'd love for you to come
watch. I was going to say, please let me know. All right.
Randy said he'd definitely be at the next game. and then ask Carter for a little catch.
Right where I headed. You see the smile on my face, Carter? This is bringing back memories.
Seems now Iowa isn't the only state.
Pop up.
With a field of dreams.
It's what I've always wanted for him.
I'm sure a lot of people across the country now are realizing that's not just a bucket of balls anymore.
No. It's a fountain of youth and a binding force for generations. Steve Hartman, CBS News, on the road.
I'm watching Sully closely because I know you posted a picture of your boy over in Montana getting ready for some college football, and I know how much you loved coaching him, too.
Yeah, and you wouldn't believe how many of my friends posted that note and that bucket of balls all over Facebook through the baseball families that we all have, the guys that are my age now that have finished playing catch with their boys pretty much because they've moved on to college. I got those buckets of balls in my garage. I've got buckets of wiffle balls. I've got buckets of regular balls. I got buckets of, turf balls, whatever you want. I'm looking forward to a catch from Tommy when he gets back for the holidays.
Yeah.
I got buckets of tennis balls.
It's the same thing.
It's going to be a few years before the grandkids are old enough, but let's cross my fingers, right?
Yes.
It is,
you'll get there.
Yeah. And now from the Gian Ursula Show, which starts at 9 o'clock right here on Cairo Radio, here is G. Scott. I have to say, the Vikings' decision to go for it on fourth down in hopes of getting a touchdown, that was a big break. Don't you agree?
It was a big break, and it was something that they had to do. Here's why. They knew the Seattle Seahawks have number 3. That's what it was. That's what it was all about. Uh-huh. They're like, look, we need to go for it. We cannot give that man the ball. Because if we give him the ball, we've seen it before. Which brings me to my next story. By the way, I apologize. I'm on about 4 or 5 cups of coffee this morning.
It's okay.
Yeah, but I just want to really be crystal clear. The old saying goes, you don't appreciate things until they're gone. You don't appreciate someone until they're gone. Folks, we have witnessed greatness. We have had the privilege of watching Russell Wilson do some of the most amazing things. That man is so good at quarterback that I believe that it's our fault that sometimes he doesn't get the respect on the national level. Here's why. Because every single time he gets ready to get the ball and he's getting ready to do this heroic thing, we, the fans, the 12, the Seahawks fans in Seattle, all over, we say things like, oh, it's Russell. He this is what he gonna do. And he does it, and we're like, oh, there he does it again. Like, this is amazing. The fact that this dude does it time and time again, he might be one of the most clutch athletes in history.
Absolutely.
Like, think about it for a second, guys. Really think about it. When he gets the ball in that situation, most of us are like, yeah, we're going to win. Like, it was great. It was phenomenal that DK caught the ball and Russell throws the ball. But just think for a second. Most of us, when Russell and the Seahawks got the ball back, most of us thought we were going to win. We're sitting there saying it. And what does he do? He wins. We've seen this movie before. The Seahawks are 5-0, the first time in league history. And yet still, people talk about other quarterbacks, Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson. Put some respect on number 3's name.
Why do you think that is?
You know, Colleen, that's a great question.
Thank you.
I think sometimes it comes down to, it's just how we are. Sometimes we take advantage of those that we know that are always going to be there. Sometimes,
but what about on the national level? How do you explain that on the national level?
I think it's a Pacific Northwest thing. I think it's the respect that the Pacific Northwest doesn't really get. I think it has a lot to do with East Coast bias and being, like, for an example, I remember when I went to go visit my son when I was out there on East Coast time, right, 3 hours ahead. Well, you guys, you know, West Coast is starting to enjoy a game. Maybe that's starting at 6 o'clock or 5, 6 o'clock. I'm getting tired.
They don't get to watch the magic of Russell Wilson.
I mean, It's just the bias, right? It's just how it is. College football, you know what I mean? A lot of times when the Pac-12 plays, it plays late at night. And so some of these games, East Coast time, are starting at 10 o'clock. Well, it's a Friday, Saturday night. Are you you're either asleep or you're out and about doing something at 10 o'clock at night on a Friday or Saturday night. So that's just kind of how it is. So I think that has a lot to do with people having like, well, yeah, they're good. But you would think that there would still be more respect on the national level, considering there is no other team outside of the New England Patriots that have been good this long for the last 10 years.
I think part of it is they still, I mean, the reaction I got when I moved out here all those years ago is that you're living with lumberjacks. And I think, you know, we still have that kind of vibe according to the East Coast. But I mean, there's really no challenging it now. Although answer me this.
Uh-huh.
5-0 mm-hmm. for the first time ever
mm-hmm.
in the season with no fans. Now, does that mean that are the fans helping or not, Jay?
The fans still help, guys. Listen, look, guys, I was at the stadium yesterday, and look, the fans are missed. It's hard. It's really hard not having fans in that stadium because you got to think about it, right? You don't really have the, quote, home field advantage that you would usually have. Sometimes that feels a little bit good. So when Russell and those guys, when the Seahawks score a touchdown, there's like golf claps. You know what I mean? Like, right. like it's golf claps in that stadium. Or when the opposing offense is on the field and they're like, they're checking downs and they're being able to audible without the crowd going crazy. I'm like, yo, that's not fair. We need a crowd here to really kind of make some noise. Like, when's the last time you've seen the opposing offense have a false start?
Yeah.
It doesn't happen right
G.
now.
G. Scott, 9 o'clock, Cairo Radio. Thanks, G.
See you guys.
Seattle's Morning News, this is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Treating COVID with plain old vitamin D. Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD, cardiac surgeon. Well, I might have needed your services last night, that game.
Yeah, it was a heck of a football game and a heck of a thing, but you sort of get used to Russell Wilson pulling these things out like that all the time. It's amazing.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about vitamin D. Now, was this part of the treatment that Donald Trump got?
Yeah, it was part of the treatment Donald Trump got. He did get vitamin D. And actually, the thing is, I take vitamin D, and I've been taking it for years. And it's actually gotten to be difficult to get your hands on because a lot of people have been taking it. So there was a study that came out, sort of a small study, but it was actually a pretty important study that just recently came out that showed that hospitalized patients, and that's the key, it's not outpatients, it's hospitalized patients that were being treated for COVID-19 were less likely to have life-threatening complications if they had adequate vitamin D levels. Now, one of the things that's important about that is that we get vitamin D usually from the sun, or we could get it from some dietary sources, or else we have to take a supplement. And actually, people in the Seattle area or in the Pacific Northwest in general tend to have below normal vitamin D levels because we don't get adequate sun exposure here. And so when we check vitamin D levels on people randomly, they're usually below normal. So we always recommend that people should be taking vitamin D. And I take a pretty substantial dose of vitamin D every day because of this. I think it's really important and there's a lot of benefits to it. Well, here's one as it applies to COVID-19, that in fact, if you get an infection severe enough to end up hospitalized, that actually having an appropriate vitamin D level can reduce the likelihood of you getting very sick. Now, this isn't completely new. We actually know of studies in the past that have shown the same thing for influenza as well. So it's yet another benefit of vitamin D.
Now, in terms of the president's treatment, I mean, he looked good in that speech at the White House over the weekend. He said after his recovery that this is the way everyone should be treated. Is that, in fact, what's going to happen using this combination of remdesivir and dexamethasone and vitamin D?
So Donald Trump sort of falls into the trap that a lot of patients do, right? When somebody's sick and they get better, they say, well, I got X, Y, and Z therapy and I got better. Therefore, that's how everyone should be treated. But it doesn't really work that way. And in fact, if we were to publish this, we would call it a case study. It's just an N of one, meaning that it was one person who got treated this way and did well. Now, what he's been touting is this Regeneron antiviral cocktail, which contains two different monoclonal antibodies. And monoclonal antibodies are essentially laboratory engineered proteins that act like the actual infection fighters your body would otherwise produce after being exposed to the coronavirus. Or it would be similar to taking an effective vaccine, and it mimics those aspects of the vaccine. You know, Regeneron's a good company. This is all scientifically based. They put a lot of time, effort, and money into this, and they're in a clinical trial. And I think it's very likely that it's going to prove to have some benefit. And their initial data suggests that it does. However, on a compassionate use basis, the president was able to request the drug. He got treated, and he got better. But the thing is, as we talked about before, he sort of got the kitchen sink thrown at him, right? He got the Regeneron cocktail. Mm-hmm. He got dexamethasone. He got remdesivir. He got famotidine or Pepcid. He got vitamin D. He pretty much got everything. So when that happens, you take sort of a shotgun approach. It's sort of difficult to know what is the thing, if there was a single thing that actually made the difference, or is it the entire cocktail? And again, even that is difficult to know because, you know, we don't really know the severity of his illness. You know, he was sick. It was clear. You could tell by looking at him in his first video that he published online, but he's also gotten better. And that's also clear from looking at him. And, you know, his doctors have cleared him. And so, but whether or not this single Regeneron drug was the key to his success is, you know, is just not known.
Well, I mean, you may be right there, but what I'm saying is whether or not it was key to his success isn't, and he's 74 and he got better. Isn't everybody going to say, hey, give me what he got. I want what he's taking.
Yeah, of course. But that's what happened with hydroxychloroquine, right? So some people took hydroxychloroquine and got better, but there was no medical reason or pharmacological reason that drug should work. And it was proven later that it doesn't work. This is a much more scientifically founded drug because it was really developed in an appropriate fashion specifically for the treatment of coronavirus infections. However, whether or not it actually works or is critical to recovery is yet to be known. And that's the whole purpose of doing appropriately designed clinical trials. So, yeah, people are going to hear this and say, yeah, I want the drug. You know, I want compassionate use. The president got compassionate use. But that doesn't necessarily mean that when it's all said and done, that it's going to pan out to be an effective therapy. And I think this is one of the problems with everything that's going on right now. When we talked about the initial data from the Moderna vaccine trial, right? They gave their vaccine and were able to demonstrate really significantly increased antibody levels. But the fact is we don't know if those antibodies that were produced were actually protective against the coronavirus or not. So all of this right now is anecdote, and we have to avoid anecdote in these, you know, case studies as being what drives our treatment. We really need appropriately designed clinical trials that demonstrate that a drug is safe and effective.
So what does a doctor say when his patient comes in and says, I heard the president, he said that everybody should get the treatment he did. I'll have what he's having. What does a doctor say?
Well, you know, the doctor has to be honest and say, you know, the drug's not available. And because he's the president and he had the right staff to make a compassionate use request, they were able to get it. And that's not really the case for every one of us. But, you know, we have to be careful because we also have to make sure that we're not scaring people away. So, for example, during the vice presidential debate the other night, we heard, you know, Mike Pence comment that, you know, some of the people from the opposing party were making people have fear about a vaccine. Well, that's also not good either. We have to look at it both ways. We have to, you know, keep our eyes, ears, and our minds open to what's being done. We certainly already people are skeptical about taking vaccines to begin with. So if we give people any reason to have any anxiety whatsoever, we may have a very, very, very effective vaccine that people are afraid of taking because they've heard press that scared them away from it. So we have to make sure that what we're doing is medically correct, and we really can't let the press and what people read in the news be what guides us. It has to be medically and scientifically sound. And I think it's the really unfortunate thing. I think about this every day, the really unfortunate thing about this disease becoming politicized. This really should be just about medicine and just about science. And I'm really disappointed that both political parties have turned this into an election issue. It just shouldn't be.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here is senior CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Big event coming up, Amazon Prime Day, bigger than ever. Is there anything left for any other retailer in America, Jill?
I think so, but it is really starting to narrow, frankly. And, you know, it was amazing. We had that congressional report out that kind of accused all of the large tech companies of having too much dominance. In that report, the lawmakers cited a stat that kind of blew my mind, that Amazon currently accounts for 39% of total U.S. e-commerce sales. I mean, that's just really unbelievable. And I think that with Prime Day launch, it is really forcing all the other retailers to shift their game plan. You know, Prime Day usually, as you guys know, in July, now in October. And it just so happens that it looks like it's perfectly primed, if you excuse the pun, to steal a lot of the Cyber Week punch that we usually have right after the Thanksgiving holiday.
I thought that Walmart was making a play to get a chunk of this online business. What's the status of their service?
Well, you know what? I think that it's interesting. Target, Best Buy, Walmart, they're all creating these pre-holiday events now to counter Amazon. Really interesting research out of CoreSite that found that a lot of these big boxes have shifted from their in-store experience to a blended approach. They're encouraging their customers to go shop online, then pick up their own packages curbside. In fact, more than three quarters of the top 50 store-based retailers in the U.S. are now offering curbside pickup. And CoreSite says that's going to probably creep higher in the coming months. So it's almost as if they're saying, hey, you know what, Amazon? We have a warehouse also. It's called our physical store. And we can have a lot of inventory in those stores and distribute that inventory. And I think there is some sense that because of Amazon's dominance, many consumers, if they're lucky enough to still have their jobs, are wanting to spread around their dollars to other retailers as well.
On the bigger economic picture, it looks like we're not going to get a stimulus before the election. I know there are a bunch of plans kicking around, one including sending another $1,200 to everybody. How essential is it to get that money out the door at this point?
Well, I mean, there are three buckets of need right now. We have millions of Americans who need help, right? Those Americans are people who are running low. They've kind of said, my state benefits could be starting to run out. I no longer have that extra $600 a week. I could be facing eviction. I could be facing utility bills. Those people need help. So individuals are really at risk here. The second group are the small and medium-sized businesses, and frankly, some of the larger businesses, although they have the public markets to tap. But those businesses are really seeking some help or some forbearance on some of the loans and programs that have already been created. And then finally, I think it's really been amazing that states and municipalities, which have come under a crushing financial burden, haven't started laying off more of their own workers. That could really compound the problem. So states and counties and cities, they need help very quickly, or else that will be another wave of layoffs that will contribute to the pandemic-induced recession.
So at this point, I saw a piece this morning, Jamie Dimon, the legendary financier, is saying we've got another year of this. I mean, I don't see how families who suddenly find their paychecks cut off for like a year. I mean, how do people hold out that long?
Well, I think that the economy is unlikely to recover its pre-pandemic size and strength pretty much. I think there's some consensus around this till the end of next year. It means that many people are going to continue to suffer, and it makes the case that there must be additional congressional action as quickly as possible. You know, as the Federal Reserve Chair said, Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve can keep interest rates low. They have the authority to lend, but only Congress can spend. And I think the hope is that after the election, whatever the results are, that lawmakers will come to the table and knock out a deal. They're not that far apart right now. It's just that the composition of the deal really seems to be a sticking point.
CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you.
Great to be with you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.